It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo, South America, Australia, France, Germany, UK, Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, off and running on this 24th day of May, 2023. This is the Horn, headon.live. This is where you'll find us on the interweb tubes. That's where you go if you'd like to be part of the merry, wacky, zany, real-time, madcap, multimedia extravaganza that takes place during the 3 hours in which this program is live, Monday through Friday, 5 to 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, all time zones in between and the great globe round, and whatever time it is when you're listening to the podcast. But during those aforementioned live hours, if you'd like to enhance your listening experience, do feel free to run on over to headon.live, jump into the chat room, and, well, if you do so, this very second, you'll be greeted by Squeaky. Theo was here a minute ago, but apparently he had to run. But Squeaky's there, and so am I, and more will be wandering along later, but... And hopefully somebody to, you know, moderate in case one of the odds and sods wanders by. You know, someone with a cyber lightsaber, you know. No, come on by. It'll be fun this evening. And if you happen to be listening via the podcast, and thanks to those of you who are already doing it, but need a lot more to do it too. If you happen to be listening to the podcast, well then, by all means, please feel free to like the podcast on whatever platform you're listening to it on, or and leave a comment and maybe share it to your social media page. You know, none of that costs a blessed thing. Everything here is free, of course. Nobody's getting charged. There's no paywalls or anything like that. This is just a conversation that happens to have been taking place for almost 20 years. And in fact, this month, by the end of this month, I will have passed the 20th anniversary of getting back in behind the microphone, because it was about this time in 2003 that my dear friend Dr. Bill O'Brien, who was going to be gone for 6 weeks, asked me if I would mind stepping in and covering for him in his absence over in America's fifth smallest radio market. I honestly don't remember exactly what day that was, but I know I turned America's fifth smallest radio market on its freaking ear, and that remains a point of pride for me. Hi, I'm Robin. Did I do the hi? Because I am. And it is prayer meeting Wednesday. And we got some prayer meeting Wednesday stuff. It's just such a beautiful day outside over at the Fellowship Hall kitchen of the Cathedral of Common Sense. The little old blue-haired ladies and little old blue-haired men and little old blue-haired non-binaries. It was so pretty outside that they seasoned up some slabs of ribs and trimmed them and got them on the smoker, and they were sitting there waiting for the deacons and the Fellowship Hall diners And there were mashed, well, not mashed, but smashed, you know, smashed baked potatoes on the smoker and ribs and wonderful, wonderful Dreamland sauce. Yeah. And banana pudding for dessert. A little coleslaw to go with the ribs. And I tell you what, the deacons landed on it. And no way to eat ribs and not make mass. And I got to admit, they were a little comical, the deacons were, as they were saucing and eating and then wiping their faces, trying to... And they weren't entirely successful, so after they'd had their banana pudding, made, by the way, with Lorna Doones and not vanilla wafers, it's so much better that way, made their way up a couple of flights of stairs and went out into the... parking lot where they took to smoking with the sinners, for which I have some sympathy, having once been out there doing the same. Now instead, I just stand there at the vestibule door in my Abbess's habit, with the horn solar powered cattle prod at hand, and I gave it a couple of crackles, and they took to running with it, and they still had their little barbecue sauce mouths, and they shot past me and get a couple of shots of hand sanitizer from the station there right in front of the sanctuary doorway, and blew past that ancient bowl of desiccating butter mints and came on down that blood red aisle, and they're waiting there now as we prepare for prayer meeting Wednesday. We will take up the love offering here in a moment. But every program here at the Horn begins with gratitude. This program is no different. So thanks ever so much to Josh and to Samson. They are our 24th day of the month subscribers via PayPal. And so the deacons will be moving throughout the sanctuary during the bulk of this prayer meeting Wednesday, whether we're doing prayer meeting stuff or other stuff, because we are, and it seems to happen about this time every month, but we're in a well. There's no doubt about that. In fact, it's $1,658 deep. And that's rough because, well, there are bills. We kept the power on. Internet's still on, but there are still bills that have to be paid. You know, groceries are nice. It's nice to be able to put fuel in the vehicle. It's nice to, well, I've got an appointment tomorrow that's got to be paid in cash because neurombolostis is one of the millions upon millions of uninsured Americans. Not by choice. But I am, and I have an appointment tomorrow that, at this point in time, I can't pay for. So, if you're inclined to help out, this would be a great time, because tomorrow's going to be a $100 day, which pretty much don't have. That's where we are. So, with that having been said, I'm going to call the Minister of Music forward to lead us in our offertory hymn. Minister of Music, if you would kindly do the honors as the deacons move throughout the congregation.
And he said, it's time for you to leave behind the things of this world, the fine houses, the fancy cars, the flashy clothes, because we are all naked in the eyes of the Lord.
Stop! This man is clinically insane.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen.
Amen.
Let me hear you say, Praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little plate when it comes around.
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah!
Hallelujah!
Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Praise Him for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, He's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man, don't you know? He should have used our accountants for his cash flow. Stop the Sermon on the Mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest, he'd be rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD, just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, plenty of moolah, solid gold baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity. Whoever said religion should be free?
Oh, hot soot, Ralston on the real raw, and a brawl of suet. Hey, man, I love you. Welcome, brethren, sisters, welcome, and non-binary members of the congregation as well. Welcome to the Cathedral of Common Sense and Prayer Meeting Wednesday. I'm calling on you now, because we do our altar call at the beginning of the service, not at the end, because everybody's in a hurry to get out to lunch or dinner or whatever after the end of the service. I'm calling on you, please, get up off of your seats and onto your feet and screech and scrooch and scrunch and wiggle and waggle and waddle out from betwixt the pews into the center aisle and come on down, out glory, that blood-red aisle. Fall upon your knees. Oh, amen. At the altar. Lay your hands upon the subwoofer and feel the healing rays of common sense flowing through you from the server on high. Amen. Glory. I am Archpope, Uber Rabbi, Ultimate Imam, Animated Animist, Antagonized Agnostic, Vicarious Vicar, Maximum Metropolitan, Naughty Nun, Aggravated Abbess, Maximum Mother Superior, Robin Kincaid, and it is Prayer Meeting Wednesday on the Horn. Amen and amen. And we do a little deep dive to begin this here Prayer Meeting Wednesday. Yes. Because you see, recently, an individual somewhere out there in the land of the interweb tubes decided to unburden themselves of their ignorance. Some idiot over on the Facebooks posted a picture of a woman with a lot of makeup on and a rather frilly headpiece and said, in the Bible, demons refer to themselves as they, them, we, us. Because nothing gets a good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, homosexual Christian worked up like some pronouns. Yes. It is fact. Mm-hmm. The post in particular, referring to the aforementioned demons, cites Mark 5:1-5 and verse 13 as well. Mark 16:9 and Luke 11:24-26 and Luke 8:2 and Matthew 8:31. Omaha! to say that demons refer to themselves with they, them pronouns. One incredibly silly individual responding said, "So much of what is going on right now, the Bible describes it. It is amazing." Another said, "Wow, never looked at it this way." And so it has been making its way around social media lately. The only problem is, we are talking, of course, about Elizabethan English. And as Steve in New York, Brother Usher Steve points out, so too does God Almighty use they, them, and we, us. True. And since about, I think the 1300s. Yes, Emilio, they, them, we, us are legion. But since the 1300s, maybe around 1340 or so, they and them has been used in the singular number when describing someone whose identity one does not know. But goodness gracious, that doesn't stop the stupidity from running around the interweb tubes. Oh no, not at all. In that Mark passage, Mark 5, Jesus says, "Demon, what's your name?" And he says, "Tony." And he says, "Fuck you, Tony. What's your name? Ezekiel. Fuck you, Ezekiel." No, that's not in there. Uh-oh. F-bombs early in the program. Incoming! Jesus says, "What's your name?" And he says, My name is Legion, for we are many." In other words, there was a whole passel of demons. And that they're possessed individual, assuming, of course, that one believes in the in demons. And there were so many demons that Jesus exorcised them, put them on little demon treadmills and running with their little cloven hooves. You know, it occurred to me, we've been joking about marginal trailer queen, the spork-footed demon, and I think that's what she is. I'm willing to put aside my agnosticism long enough to think that Marginal Trailer Queen is, in fact, a demon. Because it turns out, as every demon does, she's got cloven hooves, y'all. Mm-hmm. But anyway, there's so many demons in the person that he runs them all out into a herd of pigs. And then they run over a cliff and fall to their death in the sea. Kind of makes one wonder, given the disdain in which swine were held in that time and place, what a herd of pigs is doing wandering around in Judea, Palestine. Yeah, oh well. But as a function of good English grammar, when the demon says, "My name is Legion, for we are many," the rules of English grammar suggest that it's good English. It was written by some of the best English scholars of the era there, putting the King James Bible together. Luke 11 has 7 demons. Over to the USA Today, they contacted a guy by the name of Mark Goodacre, professor of religious studies at Duke. And as is often the case with people who aren't out there watching the culture on a daily basis like we do here, he was kind of flabbergasted to find out that somebody would say something so stupid. But say it, they did. And he went on to say that, you know, this was all written in Greek. And it doesn't have she, her, he, him, they, them, we, us pronouns. The pronouns are implied in the form of the verb. The same applies to Latin. And Professor Goodacre said, if you're saying a person has many demons, many spirits, the only way to refer to that is to say they, them. It simply doesn't make any grammatical sense to say it any other way. Up to Harvard, there's another professor, Benjamin Dunning, cited in the article, who said the idea you'd use the plural pronouns they, them in a reference to plural entities is just sort of common sense. It doesn't have anything to do with gender. It's absurd. When you look them up, it doesn't actually make the point that the poster's suggesting it makes. Demons refer to themselves as they, them, we, us. Well, so do regular people in plural situations. You know, we the people in order to form a... Right. Exactly. So, there we are. I forget who I was talking to recently, and we mentioned the fact that we haven't heard from A.W. Jackson in a while, but lo and behold, back in 2017, 6 long years ago, ciphering on the fly, y'all, he said using they-them pronouns is a subconscious spiritual admission of demon possession by multiple demons. Okay. Whatever gets you through the night, E-Dub. Oh, Jackson. And a reminder, I use that that silly voice for E-W Jackson because that was the mocking tone used by the Pineapple Prince of Hell, back when he was still in his mortal earthly form upon this mortal coil, to mock the Reverend Jesse Jackson. So. But pronouns are driving the right wing absolutely bananas. It's bad. They're in a complete, total tizzy. There ain't no pronouns. I've literally seen it. There ain't no pronouns in the Bible. Well, the King James Version there is, or the English translation of the Vulgate there sure are. But never mind. There is a university in New York State called Houghton, H-O-U-G-H-T-O-N University. I don't get a pronouncer. There were a couple, for those of you who at some point in time endured the college experience, the on-campus dormitory life, you probably had someone called an RA, a residential advisor. And, well, there were two RAs in a couple of dorms at Houghton University. Oh, they're called dorm directors now. And they did what many people are doing nowadays, and that is to put their pronouns in their email signatures or on social media. You know, if you look me up on Leon Scum's tawdry little site, you'll find it says she, her. And in this case, Shua Wilmot and Reagan Zelaya put their pronouns at the bottom of their emails, in their email sigs. For instance, Shua Wilmot put he, him, and Reagan Zelaya put she, her. It's noteworthy to make a point of saying that neither of these individuals are anything but cisgender. And lo and behold, school officials at the Christian University shit-canned them because they included pronouns in their email signatures. The university demanded, the Christian University demanded that they remove the she, her, and he, him from their emails, and they said no. They were fired last month after saying that they were going to keep their pronouns in there. And so the two are pushing back. The university, meanwhile, is trying to dodge this particular controversy by saying, "Well, Reagan's a liar, made defamatory remarks about our diversity efforts, and Shua Wilmot threatened to publish an open letter to the general superintendent of the Wesleyan Church about its views on gender." Oh, for pity's sakes. Reagan Zelaya changed her email signature so it would match the university's fonts and colors and sizes and other formatting, and put her pronouns in. And she included a link so people could schedule meetings with her. And she said, "I was being fired because my email signature was not aligned with institutional policy, and they specifically mentioned my pronouns, but they don't mention my meeting link that I had at the bottom, which wasn't institutional policy either. It just shows the priority of what was bothering, though, about my email signature." And Shua Wilmot said, "In my role, I don't post my phone number. Where I would put my phone number, I instead put he, him." And Shua Wilmot had a decent reason for it. He said, "My full name's Joshua. I don't use it. I just go by Shua. And sometimes I get misgendered. And it doesn't much bother him. But he realized people feel bad when they have thought he was a girl when he's a cisgender guy." Same thing happened with Reagan Zelaya, because some cis boys are named Reagan. They usually have Republican parents of a certain age. But Reagan Zelaya said, "It felt like a way that I can show solidarity with the people who don't have that privilege of being addressed as a woman the minute they meet me." And including the pronouns normalizes it and helps to empower others to do the same. Ah, but the Christians at Houghton University aren't having it, y'all. No. Of course not. So, you know, just a little something to get us started. There's a good bit out there to keep us busy for the next 2.5 hours or so. But it is Wednesday, and we like to hit the high points of the religion of peace. One of the places where those manifestations often happen is, of course, when followers of Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and semi-literate itinerant rabbi who wore a dress every day of their life, or so they say. One of the problems they run into is when they start trying to declare what is and is not Merkin history. Here, let's check in with a gospel sharp by the name of Jesse Duplantis. At the beginning, in the first week of this month, a whole bunch of mouth-walking, knuckle-breathing, floor-rolling, tongue-speaking, strychnine-swigging, oil-pouring Christians got together in Nash Vegas, Tennessee for 2 days of grunting and bleating. They called it Flashpoint Live at Cornerstone Church. Because I guess Flashpoint is something that airs on Kenneth Copeland's television network. One of these days on that great getting up morning, Kenneth Copeland's going to stand before the gates of glory, if those do indeed exist, which I sincerely doubt. And a big booming voice is going to come over those assembled and say, "Where did I ever say to have a TV network? Where in my book does it say for you to become a billionaire, Kenneth? Hope you brought your asbestos long johns, because your asbestos is off to hell." Anyway, televangelist Jesse Duplantis, who hustles the prosperity gospel and talks a lot about how rich he is, you know, "Wave your donations in the air. We'll charge a fee on every prayer." He's also a Christian nationalist. And he likes to blather on about how God founded the new 90 states of America, the greatest country in the history of the world on earth now today, forever in the universe under God. Get the duct tape, because this is going to be a Lulu. Promise.
God did something with the United States of America that he never did with any other nations, because he created it with a Judeo-Christian ethic. And he gave a vision to four men way back when this nation started off.
You know who didn't get a say in whether or not this country was founded as a Judeo-Christian republic, which, by the way, it wasn't at all. Neither God, Jehovah, Yahweh, Ichwech, the Most High, El, none of the references for God on a Judeo-Christian basis, Deus, nope, Theo, hi Theo, no, they're not in the Constitution of the United States. There's a reference to God and nature's God in the Declaration of Independence, but it really doesn't count. But I want to hear more about these four men that received a hallucination from the great big bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky.
One was George Washington, the first president of the United States. Number two was Alexander Hamilton, the first secretary treasurer of the United States.
Also a philanderer, Alexander Hamilton. For those of you who have seen the production Hamilton, the play actually covers the philandering. There's a scene and a song where Alexander Hamilton prays, singing, that he won't be compelled to, or feel compelled to, have sex with a woman whose man has run off. A girl, to be sure. A girl. Barely a woman at all. Spoiler, Alexander Hamilton did not resist temptation. And then it turned out that the woman's husband wasn't gone at all and was actually acting more as her pimp. And of course, Alexander Hamilton was involved in a Christian marriage between one man and one woman. And they had a bunch of young'uns. He apparently, well, never mind. And they blackmailed the shit out of him over his philandering ways. Because, see, Alexander Hamilton was married to a woman whose last name was Schuyler. And the Schuylers were one of the most, I mean, they were like Cabots in Massachusetts, okay? They were the social and political and cultural cream of the crop in late 18th century New York and New York politics. George Washington, of course, was an enslaver. Let's see who else is on the list.
Secondly, the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Jay. And then the fourth president of the United States, James Madison. And through those four...
James Madison, also an enslaver. He had all that leisure time to sit around coming up with groovy notions like the impeachment clause and separation of powers and all of those ideas that are in the Constitution because... He never really had to lift a finger for himself. James Madison never washed a single dish. James Madison never laundered a single item of his clothing, not even down to his little lace undies. No. He had enslaved people to do all of that for him. It's only worth remembering. John Jay, I mean, he wrote five of the Federalist Papers. Out of 85, Madison and Hamilton wrote the rest of them. But nonetheless, apparently, the great big bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky inspired those four men.
Four men, God gave the vision of America. About America. What they should do. And it started out with George Washington, and he appointed Alexander Hamilton, and he appointed the Chief Justice and different things of that nature. So what happened?
And different things of that nature is sort of a placeholder for, I haven't come up with a creative enough lie for those things, but watch this space. Jesse Duplantis, Steve in New York asks, isn't he one of those ones who got his lemmings, I mean congregants, otherwise known as rubes, to buy him a couple of airplanes? Oh yeah, he brags about how filthy rich he is. And by the way, going back to the pronoun story a minute ago, Steve in New York with a question says, I will be very honest. Designating one's pronouns is not that important to me. I don't put how I want people to refer to me. However, I understand that it is important to some as a way of self-identifying or it is a way of showing solidarity with people for whom it is important. My question is this. Is this any different than, say, John F. Kennedy saying, call me Jack? Let me add to that, Steve. The very same people who say, I ain't gonna use no pronouns, are the people who will look at a 50-year-old full-grown man with an entirely different name and nonetheless call him Kid Rock, when neither Kid nor Rock are a part of his name. See how it works? And in this political climate, when you put, in your case, Steve, he, him, on your email signature, you are, in fact, letting people know who you are, what your pronouns are, and that you will, in turn, be respectful of others' identities. And the dead giveaway for all of this is when some jackass says, "Oh, identifies an Apache attack helicopter." Becomes so wearying. Thank you, Ralphs. Ralphs is there this evening. I'm offering a $25 challenge for Robin's doctor appointment tomorrow. Thank you. Thank you, Ralphs. I appreciate that. So $25 gets doubled, and further, with a reference that probably almost everybody already understands, an anonymous friend has said, "I'd like to put forth a $67 Big Wheels Keep On Turning 2-for-1 tripling challenge. $33 gets 67 from me." Proud Mary. Tina Turner passed away today at the age of 83. I saw that news come across my feed, probably a little bit before 3 p.m. this afternoon. And that hit hard. That hit really hard. Because she was one amazing woman. Endured more than 10 years of brutal physical and mental abuse at the hands of Ike Turner. In some instances, even going on stage with her face battered because he loved to hit her about the face so that people would see it when she was on stage, because there was no way she wasn't going on, because they needed the money. When she left him, she left with a mobile gasoline credit card, $0.25, $0.10, and 1 penny in her purse. After that, she began pulling her career back together. And eventually hit it big with, first she covered Al Green's Let's Stay Together in, I think, 1983. And then 1984, she put out the Private Dancer album that included a single that was an absolute smash called What's Love Got to Do with It. To this day, I will still just absolutely howl that at the top of the lung, top of my lungs, when it comes on and I'm by myself in the car. A lot of songs that I used to sing when nobody was watching. That was one of them. She made it through 83 strong, proud, fierce years. She was raised in the Baptist church in a little town north of Memphis, a little community north of Memphis called Nutbush, from whence we got Nutbush City Limits, an autobiographical song that she wrote. Yeah, the mid-80s were big for Tina, because the next year she scored the theme song for the latest Mad Max movie, you know, Beyond Thunderdome and We Don't Need Another Hero. I hope her passing was peaceful. And I hope she left this earth knowing what a profound impact that she had had, particularly to give courage and uplift to women who had been involved in domestic and spousal abuse. Thanks for that challenge to our anonymous friend. And that anonymous challenge already has $10 on it. So there are 23 dollars left to go on that, and 25 to go on Ralph's challenge. So that would get us to 100. That would knock down the fundraising goal by $150, which is a big deal, a very big deal, especially this time of the month. Thank you to our anonymous friend. Thank you, Ralph's, and thank you. Thank you, Christopher, jumping in, saying, "Big wheels!" Exclamation point. Yes. Thank you. Nutbush City Limits. Proud Mary, covering a Creedence Clearwater Revival song. And after their acrimonious divorce, the court let Ike Turner keep the rights and royalties to most of the work that that Tina and Ike had done together. That didn't slow Tina Turner down. She just went out, reinvented herself, and came back more fierce than she had ever before been. And like I said, she was raised Baptist. But in her, early 50s, she converted to Buddhism and said it all just made sense to her. That what we are, what we become, is a function of change. And she remained a Buddhist for the rest of her life. Yeah, it really messed with me too, Ralph. Ralph said, "Oh no, R.I.P. Tina Turner, 83, and a life well lived." So I'm far more comfortable talking about the passing of Tina Turner, and frankly, I think that is far more significant in the grand scheme of things than anything that. Tina wore go-go boots, too, but she wore them with style and panache, as opposed to that little go-go-booted pipsqueak, fascist pipsqueak in Florida. Now that never mind. Fuck him. Right? Right. But I was going to say something, and we can go back to Jesse Duplantis. I frankly don't care. He's a liar, and he lies about American history, and he lies about the fact that every one of those men he mentioned were, in fact, deists. We would call them agnostics today. They thought there might be some sort of power out there, but they were also, although they were rich and white and powerful, humble enough to think that maybe they ought not be running around defining the nature of whatever the most powerful force in the universe was. I got misgendered Friday evening. After I finally got the interweb tubes back on, I went out to get a bite for Annette and me. And when I placed the order, I said, "Oh, by the way, don't put any lettuce on my sandwich." And the person turned around. This is someone I know, someone I consider a friend. And she turned around and looked at the cook and says, he said he doesn't want lettuce on his sandwich. And every time she said he, I said she. And when she said his, I said her. And, well, it stung. A little bit later, she came back, came over to me and said, I did something horrible, and I'm so sorry. I said, it's okay. Don't worry about it. And I went on and explained, you know, we're not crawling with tourists right now, but if this place was packed with tourists, misgendering me could get me beaten or killed. And that's the reality. Pronouns are a matter of personal safety. Steve, check your text messages. There's no way, real way for me to deal with this otherwise, but check your text messages. I just sent you a photo of exactly what I looked like when I got he, and his. And it kind of ruined my night. Because then you have to go and you have to search and evaluate and figure out what you did wrong. And nine times out of... But the funniest thing is, perfect strangers, I don't get misgendered anymore. It's the people who know me and know that I'm trans that will make that mistake most often. It's a hell of a thing. And let me see here. I should note that, here in a few minutes, I'm going to have a guest on the program. Helene Fisher will be popping by. She was here last when we were talking about her last collection of poetry that came out, in which she documented poetically a memoir of her experience dealing with her husband, our friend Dan's, heart transplant. Well, she has a new collection of poems out, and I've read it. She kindly provided me with an electronic review copy. It's wonderful work. And we'll be talking about that in fairly short order. But let's get a couple more minutes of Jesse. To hell with Jesse Duplantis. I'm going to take a couple of minutes and deal with old balls and strikes. Old Balls and Strikes John Roberts went to an awards dinner in Washington, D.C. yesterday. The timing was less than optimal because it was the same day that Mbop, the pettifogger for Har Har Crow, bought me a Supreme Court justice. Har Har Har! Sent his letter to the Senate Committee on the Judiciary telling them that they had no business investigating him or the Supreme Court. And so, at the awards dinner, Old Balls and Strikes said, we are continuing to look at things we can do to give practical effect to the commitment, and I'm confident there are ways to do that consistent with our status as an independent branch of government and the Constitution's separation of powers. I want to assure people that I'm committed to making certain that we as a court adhere to the highest standards of conduct.
Sure.
Sure you are. Yeah, thanks, Steve. Fuck Jesse DeCracker. Absolutely. Yeah, let's just make him go away. And I've got
Hello?
There we are. Okay. I think we're good here. I don't know how John Roberts said what he said about the highest standards of conduct and kept a straight face. But then again, being shameless may be a huge part of it. Well, let's run over to the Skype line. Helene Fisher is with me. And as I said earlier, she has a new book of poetry out. Jane Almost Always Smiles. The minute I saw the title, I was intrigued to say the least. It is published by Moonstone Press of Philadelphia, PA. And I have enjoyed reading it immensely. Helene, good afternoon, good evening. How are you?
Hello, I'm well. How are you?
As we say down here, fine as frog hair cut four ways.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
It is so lovely to talk to you. The last time, as I mentioned earlier in introducing you, last time we talked, you had a new collection out, a memoir form of poetry, I would call it, documenting your experience dealing with your husband Dan's heart transplant.
Yes.
And, God, how long ago was that, Helene?
Sterile Field is a year old. It came out on May 20th in 2022.
Okay, so that was a little after, long about that time we were talking, and we had a lovely, fascinating conversation, powerful conversation, and I think this one will be similar.
Thank you.
You dedicate it to Belle Gail Chivini, mm-hmm. who taught you how to read. Let's start with that.
Mm-hmm. She was my mentor in undergraduate school at college, at Purchase College. And I didn't mean read literally so much as taught me how to really analyze what I was reading and to read between the lines. And since Jane Almost Always Smiles centers around my first grade teacher, I was thinking about an important teacher in my life. And Belle passed away fairly recently, so it just kind of felt right to dedicate the book to her. I felt like she just taught me a lot. And I was working on my senior thesis with her when my mom passed away. And Belle, who was the mother of two young women, she just sort of stepped up. I felt her support and presence. She was a very, very special teacher, wonderful professor, wonderful writer. Very beloved in the Purchase community and beyond.
That's beautiful. And we have a tendency to remember, even if we're not necessarily trying to, the ones who touch us in terms of helping us make leaps in our academic careers. I can go all the way back to first grade, and those were some amazing women, and I say go back to first grade because Jane Almost Always Smiles takes as its point of departure those series of pre-primers and primers out of which an entire generation, multiple generations of Americans learned to read the Dick and Jane series. I know. Yep. I did.
Yeah, me too.
But as you say, you learned to read between the lines. You learned to read critically in college. Mm-hmm. And you've gone back and you've you have reimagined or revisited or reimmersed yourself in what it was that you were actually being immersed in.
Mm-hmm.
With those seemingly, and I say seemingly for a reason, innocuous books.
Yeah. Yes. Books that stayed with me. You know, I think that part of what happens with poetry and maybe any kind of writing and maybe any kind of art, in fact, is a kind of obsession and or something sort of keeps haunting. And I went back to thinking about that first grade classroom just in numerous times. And finally, during the COVID quarantine, went and began writing about it. Those books were so vivid, and the dynamic in the classroom for having to read out loud, that memory of, I was an earlier reader, so I always skipped ahead, and then I got lost, you know, when the teacher called on me to read from the book. These books are called primers for early reading, and I began to think about what else that time was priming me for of first grade, which was, you know, the introduction to the institution of education, the power dynamic of a classroom, of what the teacher says goes. And this was a teacher who gave out gold stars, blue stars, you know, red stars, depending on how good of a student you were.
I lived for those stars.
Yeah, right? And this was also a teacher that I think, in my recollection, was pretty shame-based, because if you didn't earn a silver or gold star, you felt terrible. At least I did.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that, you know, what does that say about how we were taught? I mean, this book to me is about what we are taught and what the rules are, sort of our introduction to rules, the ABCs of rules, and what we learn we can't say no to. And that includes our educational systems, our parents, our governments. You know, there's so many things that we have to learn the rules from. And I really wanted to explore that. And it's, for me, in my mind, it started in my first grade teacher's room, who I call Mrs. W. And I wouldn't say the book wrote itself, but it was surprisingly accessible, this material, for me. Something would occur to me and I would write it, and it would snowball from one poem to the next. So it was a really interesting process. And again, written during quarantine, right? Like it was written, you know, pretty quickly, considering how much got written.
Well, you know, years ago. Let's take a moment with Dick and Jane. And everybody always leaves out Sally.
Yes. Figures she's sort of a centerpiece in this book.
Yes.
Little Sally.
Talk about a little bit about the America, because this reading series was primarily an American phenomenon.
Yes.
Talk about the difference, because I see you writing about it in here, and mm-hmm. I got handed the same books. In fact, like you, I mean, my grandmother and my aunt were both teachers. And they were sending spare copies of these books to me when I was two. Yeah. When I was two.
Yeah. Wow.
And so I'd already been through all this by the time first grade came around.
Got you. Yeah.
And it was, frankly, horribly simplistic. And it was...
I'm saying, oh, as a surprise, because having now written Jane Almost Always Smiles, that was part of what was kind of so surprising for me, was the more I dug into the books, and I concentrated on one in particular, the more I saw how it's not so simplistic. The language seems simplistic, but there's so many layers to it. Anyway, I just wanted to.
No, I get it, but it's, you know, it was a world that, for a number of reasons, I couldn't identify with it.
Right.
You have a passage about why do the girls in the books play dress up? They're always dressed up.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, by 1969, like. Yeah, well, you know, why, but never mind that. The books, it was hard to identify with them because, you know, their dad came home every day at the same time. Their mom was always perfect.
Yep.
And I'm pretty sure that my first grade class in Alabama was the first grade class to be fully integrated.
Mm-hmm.
So... Black kids and white kids started together. And it was one of the things, I had my high school reunion this past fall, and we were all there again. And, you know, now as older adults, we're looking at each other going, you realize what an experiment they did on us? But the fact of the matter is, you know, my dad might be at work from 8 to 5 or 4 to 12 or 12 to 8. He might be asleep depending on what shift he was on. And all of that perfection that was reflected in those books was not a part of my reality.
Well, can I ask you something? When you call it perfection, did it seem like perfection because that's what the books were modeling? Was it some sort of idea of what perfection should look like?
Well, it was an ideal of what an American family looked like, or at least a... Well, white middle class American family.
Well, and therein lies the rub. I ended up adding an author's note to this book because when I started submitting the book to publishers for publication, one of the things that I began to figure out just through conversations while workshopping the book and having it out in the world a little bit was that not everybody, you know, for younger folks, they didn't know the books necessarily, and people from other countries didn't grow up with the books. And so I felt it was really important to anchor the reader in some background about it. And I'm wondering, for the sake of your audience, I don't want to assume they're familiar with these books, if I should read a little bit from that author's note to give you.
I think it would be beneficial if you did.
Okay, so the first Dick and Jane book was published in 1930. And by the 1950s, 80% of first grade students, 80% in the United States, myself included, were introduced to reading with this series of books, which featured three siblings from a white, middle-class, suburban family. The books remained in use through the 1970s. Now, over time, the books were criticized for being ineffective teaching tools and for perpetuating racial, gender, and class biases. And there's a many, many books in the Dick and Jane series. The one that I focused on was called simply Sally, Dick, and Jane, which came out in 1962. And that was my primary source. But, you know, the Dick and Jane books are considered by some to be collector items. You can go online and buy vintage copies. So I had found this particular version of the book online, and, you know, just read it over and over and over and kind of, and wrote from it in a way. There's a poetic term, ekphrastics. And when you're writing an ekphrastic poem, it means you're writing from it. It's usually a piece of art, like a painting. But this was like writing from these books and reacting to it. So that is the background of it. They, you know, they're controversial. At the end of the day, they were problematic. There were, in the later books, there were some Black people in them. But the books are primarily grounded around Dick and Jane, and certainly a suburban family with a classic mom and dad. And, you know, mom wears pearls and a dress. That's how mom looks.
Yeah. So that, when's the last time you saw somebody, well, I don't know, unplugging a sink drain in pearls?
Right. I may start. I mean, we should all take it up. Right. Exactly. Exactly. Or tucking your kids in, you know, to bed at night in a dress and pearls. Not because you're about to go out, but because that's just how you're dressed.
I mean, it's just, it's what's done. I loved your observation that the light is always the same in every panel.
Yes. Yes. I was really struck by, you know, they're very colorful books. And I was very much struck by the, I guess you would say, the uniform tone of the images. The very saturated colors. And so that if you're not changing the light, even if it's bedtime, the light is the same as the page of a child running after a puppy. And that to me felt, you know, it's not real. It's a little claustrophobic, in fact. But you have entered this world of Dick and Jane. It's as palpable as a mother always wearing pearls, in my estimation.
I think you're right. And to the extent that these books did not exist in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
This was an America that was being sold by and large.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is, you know, by the time it's running in reruns when I'm 7 or 8 years old, you know, Leave It to Beaver has been off the air for longer than I've been alive.
Yeah, amazing, right?
But the Leave It to Beaver world is the same world that's in the Dick and Jane books.
Very much so. I mean, they really sort of look alike. Also, Dennis the Menace, like that whole genre of early television.
Ozzie and Harriet.
Mm-hmm.
And even later on, the Brady Bunch. I mean,
yep.
They had a little controversy every now and then. You know, poor Marcia getting a football in the nose. Oh my nose! Oh my nose! Oh my nose!
Well, you know, they had a housekeeper, so mom, you know, she occasionally cooked, and maybe you saw her folding laundry or something like that. But Carol Brady was always well turned out in her, you know, lovely. With her lovely shag haircut and little suits that she wore, little outfits that she had on, groovy little mini dresses and so forth.
Well placed use of the word groovy.
Yeah, very groovy, very groovy. Well, even Mary Tyler Moore. I mean, this whole idea of, you know, what does a woman look like?
Yes.
Right.
And what does she do?
And what does she do? Yeah. And for me,
you know, did she give birth to Dick and Jane and Sally with the same pearls on?
Right. I sure hope so. I sure hope so. You know, the thing is that I had a mom who worked and who was a political activist. And I, you know, as there were certain things I just, and also I grew up in a town that had all kinds of people in it from all kinds of backgrounds. It really struck me even as a child that this wasn't a real reality. It was some kind of reality, but it wasn't my reality. And that juxtaposition, if that's the right word, between sort of being consumed inside of this, drawn into this sort of vacuum world of Dick and Jane, with the reality of a working woman who's teaching the class, of course, who, you know, there was never hair out of place, as I recall, and who was not particularly, as I recall, warm or friendly, who set up, as I said earlier, these different power dynamics. You know, it's a lot for a six-year-old to process. And you were probably the same way, was a very thinky kid, right?
Yes.
So, you know, nothing got by me easily. The rivers ran deep. And obviously, it stayed with me for all these years. It made such a huge impression. But it was also, I went to nursery school and I went to kindergarten. So I had already been kind of inducted into the educational system. But first grade is certainly kind of a step further into that system. It's longer hours, bigger room, bigger classrooms and class size and so forth. So, you know, it's a very powerful time for a young person, I think. And I say that now, you know, as someone who went through it, but also as a mother of two children and, you know, watching them through school, which I never really liked until I got much older. I loved to learn, but it wasn't really until college that I liked school. And when I got married, you know, I married someone who liked school. And I said, look, you know,
really? Dan? Like school? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think my husband was just good at it. And I was a bright kid. But, you know, he was the type of person, still is, that would take a standardized test and fly through it because he was so logical. I was such a creative thinker that I could, you know, if you give me a multiple choice test, I can tell you why each of those options probably would work. So school and I were a funny fit from the get-go. But, you know,
a little bit of a square peg, were you?
A little bit. And, you know, and the book became much less, it's not really about learning the actual ABCs so much as the cultural and emotional ABCs, which matters.
I'm very fortunate in that I have friends, one in particular, who grew up in my small town.
Mm-hmm.
She was there for me, waiting on me when I came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I love her. I love her. I love her like the sister that she is. But we've sat and compared notes, and I go back to that. Hey, we were being experimented on. With the constant, it seemed like constant standardized testing.
Yeah.
And nobody knew it. And I don't mean to turn this into a trip down memory lane because of this. Your book is so much more than that. It's you sort of synthesizing what you experience. I don't know why I say sort of. It's you synthesizing your experience within the context of what was being presented to you via external stimuli.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of every class year, you would find out who you got for a teacher the next year.
Yes.
And there was always, and the kids, you know, they had a network. There was a coconut telegraph. And it was, oh, you want this teacher, not that teacher. She's easy.
Mm.
She'll work you. The other one will work you to death. And so, I went through elementary school pretty much with the same group of kids every year.
Yeah, me too.
Even though there were a lot more kids in the school.
Mm-hmm.
And in the grade level.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're sitting there, please, please, don't let me get hurt. Don't let me get hurt. Don't let me get hurt. Please do not. And you get her.
Right,
It's like, oh, my life's going to be a living hell. Now, you know, we don't think like that in first, second, third, fourth grade, but
yeah,
kids have a way of saying the very same thing. And time after time after time, and especially through the golden hour lensed view of 2020 hindsight, I was being put in the class of the teacher who was assigned the kids most likely to succeed.
So you were one of the smarty pants, and they kept you with fellow smarty pants.
Yes, that's not to say it wasn't difficult, but
yeah,
every time. And those teachers are the ones whose names and faces I remember.
Yeah, right. You know, I was literally in an experimental school situation. In fourth grade, I was put into the first year of what they called the free school? I think they might have. It was like the alternative education. It was literally an educational experiment.
Yeah, ours was the laboratory school, and it was attached. And it was attached to the local university, and I never got to go there. I went to the school just, you know, three blocks up from my home.
Uh-huh.
But the same experiments were taking place inside every school.
It was amazing, right. So that would have been for me. It was started in fourth grade, which was 1969. And then it was also fifth grade. And my fifth grade teacher, who was fabulous, Mrs. Goldstein, had to teach all of us basically fourth and fifth grade math to catch us up. Because most of fourth grade was, there were great things about that classroom, actually, but we spent a lot of time playing music, going for walks on the beach. I think it was the year the Mets won. So, you know, like I remember we traded baseball cards a lot.
So that's the 69 Mets, the Miracle Mets. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, fourth grade was kind of a wash. So fifth grade, we had to ramp it up a little bit, but fifth grade, we were bussed. That was the year, I was sent from one part of town to another part of town. And so everything about fifth grade was different. It was a different school building. Some new kids as well, very different kind of school. It was a very old school. Like literally the building was old, and I had gone to an elementary school that was very sort of, you know, that typical, you know, glass and brick, very modern for the time look. So school is a trip. I mean, that's kind of the bottom line for me. And raising kids and watching them go through the system, it wasn't always easy for me. You know,
I was about to ask you that very question. To what extent did you watch your kids' experience and sort of, I don't want to say triggered, but but wind up asking yourself, you know, what are they teaching these kids, or why didn't they teach me that?
I was incredibly critical of a lot of what was happening in schools here, which are, by the way, where I am in Rockland County, New York. You know, we're in this particular district, it's considered a blue ribbon school district. There's a lot of great things about it. It's a wealthy school district, meaning that the kids had what they needed in the classroom and outside the classroom for extracurriculars. I feel grateful to my children that they took after their dad in the sense of, and I do take some credit for this, that, you know, they would come home from school, they'd have some downtime, but we would sit together at the kitchen table doing homework. And they became very disciplined students. They became very good students, meaning that they understood the material. They liked to work. They liked schoolwork. Well, I don't say they liked schoolwork. They liked to learn. And they both did really well. I feel like that was just luck, like luck of the draw.
So much of parenting often is.
So much of parenting often is. But I remember being fairly appalled sitting in on an English class in the elementary school to see how books were being taught, which was, you know, completely deconstructing every book. Kids had to use post-its to, what do they call it? There's a word for it. It's at the tip of my tongue, where they had to, you know, take note of all these different things.
So annotate?
Yes, thank you. Those annotations. I mean, it was sort of sickening that they would come home with a novel just covered in post-its. And I would say to them, are you actually enjoying that book? Like, how can you possibly absorb it? I work with students now. I am a writing coach. And I've had the experience of working with kids that were working on papers for social studies in English. And I could just see how they weren't allowed to absorb what they were reading. They just had to annotate. And it was just horrifying to me.
Mechanistic.
It's very mechanistic. I think that, you know, when I work with kids on writing, a lot of times I am unteaching them a lot of things, and hoping and trying to encourage them to find some joy in what they are reading, what they are writing. It's very sad to me, and not at all productive to teach kids that way, in my opinion. So I don't mean to be harsh. I think there's...
Well, I don't think you are being. Reading is first and foremost a joyful experience.
It should be. And there are some phenomenal teachers out there that my kids were very lucky to have. I had a few wonderful teachers, you know, growing up through K through 12, particularly in high school, and a few in middle school. But I remember in middle school, we had, I think this was ninth grade, we had a test on grammar. And I got a 98 on the test, and everyone else in the class failed, and there was some crazy curve to make up for that. Now, you would have thought that the teacher would have helped me, you know, given me more to do or find ways for me to read more interesting things or something, but nothing. I mean, there was one class that I sat in high school where I was literally bored to tears, wiping my tears on my Huckapoo shirt.
Oh my God.
You know, it's education. I think of all of the dysfunctional systems in our country, I'm going to say something bold, that I think education is probably the most dysfunctional of them all. Even more than the healthcare system. And you know how I feel about that.
Yes.
I really feel like the education system in this country needs to be torn down and started way over. Again, I think there's brilliant teachers out there. I think there's some things that do work really well. But, you know, I have an aunt who used to say the cream rises to the top, meaning that, you know, if a child was not in the most exciting classroom, if they were bright and they did their work, they would do well. And I've seen that backfire with some students.
Sure.
And there's a lot of educational trauma. So
we've talked on this program in the past, Helene, about the fact that, you know, it's a running gag that I cipher poorly.
Right.
But starting with algebra, what could have been a lifelong love affair with mathematics was ruined.
Yeah, here too.
By bad teaching. And I know it was because when I did stumble across one who was good at it, well, mm-hmm. that was my summer school A in Algebra 2.
Yeah, I was doing really well. And then they gave me this whatever standardized test you take in middle school in math. And I did poorly on it. And the teacher was very surprised because I was doing well in math and liked it. And he had me take the test like on my lunch hour or something with him in the room. And I once again did poorly. And he said to me the exact thing you shouldn't say to somebody, which is he said, you should never take standardized tests. You don't know how to test. You test poorly. It's just not what you're able to do. It's like, thanks a lot.
And you know, standardized testing was something that we coped with, and it only got worse and worse and worse over time. I remember seeing our eldest getting on the bus at testing time in the spring. You know, by the time she was in middle school and high school, it had completely overtaken the curriculum.
Yes.
And she was physically ill. I mean, she threw up before school.
Oh.
Because she was so worried about it.
Yes. And now for many colleges have gone test optional, which is very interesting.
I felt like it was abusive.
Yeah. I don't disagree with you.
But I want to recenter.
Yeah.
I want to recenter the conversation on the text itself.
Oh,
because
thank you.
I could do this for the rest of the night.
No, I know. We should have an education day together sometime.
Yes. But I would like you to read from the book, please, if you don't mind, Helene.
Sure.
Would you mind sharing with us Sally, Dick, and Jane and Dad?
Yes. See Sally in the book at bedtime. Sally's mom turns out the light. At night, my mom is at work or sick in hospital. Dad, not mom, turns out the light. Dad sits in the dark and waits for me to fall asleep. He says he sits and stays so that I will not be afraid of the dark. It is easy to see things in day. Day is busy. Night has things too, but they are harder to see, except for stars and dim planets. Night is still, but when Dad sits in the dark, he moves it. When Sally, Dick, or Jane are in peril, they say, help, go, run. There is a bedtime secret. The secret is like a swear that I should trust Dad, that I should love Dad, that I should not say, help. Go, run. At bedtime, I think of mom at work or in hospital, alive or dead. Mom, alive or dead, is the bedtime story I tell myself to not think about Dad, who sits in the dark and moves it.
My God, can you talk a little bit about that's obviously autobiographical.
Mm-hmm. And yes, we should have, you know, it's just a sort of content warning that that part of what we'll be talking about is a child navigating sexual abuse. For those, you know, go take care of yourself for those who need to.
Yes.
For sure. Yes. I mean, I this is going to be a strange thing to say. I was, quote unquote, lucky in the sense that my father was incredibly sexually provocative with me, but never crossed the ultimate line. I was not raped. But I had to navigate an awful lot with him. And when I was writing this book, I became very aware of the dad in the Sally, Dick, and Jane book that I was focused on. He's not in the book at all. And there is a page in the book of Sally's mom tucking her in.
Right.
And my mom was often very ill, or she worked. So she wasn't around a whole lot. And I had three much older brothers. So there was always someone around, you know, to babysit, right? But it was something that my dad would do, and I was triggered. The memory came back to me very clearly of my dad kind of taking it upon himself to be in the room as I would fall asleep. And there was always a terrible tension there that went on for years and years.
Oh.
So really difficult stuff. Could have been worse.
Certainly.
But certainly a situation that, you know, I've spent a lot of time working on in my own life. I've written about very directly in essay form and in other forms. And I think it's an important conversation to have.
Oh, it's so critically important, Helene. I mean, I've wondered, it's been variously attributed to both Jim Morrison and Hank Williams. But the phrase about life on Earth, no one here gets out alive.
You're right. Right.
And oddly enough, I've mentioned on this program, I was talking about it last night, we are huge fans here of a show on Apple TV called Ted Lasso.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happened in the episode that dropped last night / today, there is an Englishman's poem called Your Parents Fuck You Up.
Mm-hmm.
And the owner of the pub where the program, the story often finds itself centered, repeats that to the protagonist because he's, you know, as a full-grown man, dealing with mommy issues.
Mm.
And a father who suicided, that kind of thing. And it was deep and it was profound. And when I read Sally, Dick, and Jane, and Dad, I had a sense of the unease that I think you intend to convey.
Mm-hmm.
But because, and you can tell me if you agree or disagree with this, when one engages in art, it is one of the most intense processes that there can be.
Mm-hmm.
It is far different from anything that's remotely mechanistic.
Mm-hmm.
But once you have completed it and put it in and kicked the little fledgling out of the nest to fly or corkscrew into the ground, hoping it will fly,
mm-hmm.
how other people read it or how other people perceive it, if it's a painting or a sculpture or music, or dance, theater, is entirely subjective with regard to the person doing the perceiving.
Sure.
And as a creator, you kind of have to be willing to step back from it and understand that that process is going to take place.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I read Sally, Dick, and Jane, and Dad, and I got to the line, or sick in hospital,
mm-hmm.
I time traveled. Or as yeah. As Kurt Vonnegut said, I came unstuck in time.
Hmm.
Which is such a handy phrase.
Yes, it is.
And I've spent a lot of time going back, and so I think it was like November, December of 1972 and January of 1973.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother had breast cancer.
Oh, my.
And in 1973, not just a whole lot of women survived that. And this was in a relatively small community in Alabama. And so not a word, you know, I was largely kept in the dark.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, did you know she had breast cancer?
Nobody said those words. Mama's going to have an operation.
Okay.
And I was eager and curious enough that, and this is going to sound terrible, I was like, wow!
And because you thought of it as some, you know, like a sort of Frankenstein sort of cool thing?
Yeah. It was an adventure, because everything up to then had been mostly an adventure.
Yeah.
And my mother was as strong as could be. And, oh, God, she was such a smoker, Helene.
Mine was, too. And my mom also had breast cancer when I was 15. She did not die from breast cancer.
Nor did mine.
Mm.
That was the amazing part. But my grandmother came down. and my dad had to continue to work, you know, whether, like I said, whether it was the midnight shift or the day shift or the godforsaken 4 to 12, God, he hated that. And that would change week to week to week. He never got more than 1 week on one shift pattern. And he said it will ruin a human being. And I think he was probably right. But my grandmother took care of me, and we prayed every night, and we prayed for my mother. And she came home on my 10th birthday. And they took me to see her in the hospital, and that was when, you know, little 9-year-old kid, that was when the reality of it all came through, because, you know, there was a clear tube, a drain snaking out from under the bed sheets and into a bag suspended from the bottom of the hospital bed.
Had she had a mastectomy?
She had had a total radical mastectomy of her right breast.
My mother as well. I don't remember if it was left or right, but I think it was right.
So they took everything.
Well, that's what they used to do, you know. I mean, nowadays, for the same kind of thing, they may just do a lumpectomy, for example. But, yeah.
In her case, they went so far as to take even all the lymph under her right arm, so that from that day forward, she never sweat under her right arm.
Yeah, same with my mom.
She was just skin stretched across... stretched across the frame. It was like skin, rib cage. And then they bombarded her with cobalt and burned her to a crisp. There was no there was no chemotherapy then.
The incredible thing is that my mom never had any follow-up, anything. No radiation at all, or no chemo.
Well, I think in the long run it led to my mother's demise, because I think the cobalt, she developed a condition in which her big bones stopped manufacturing white blood cells, and and her spleen took over, and it it caused her spleen to enlarge, and then she was malpracticed upon, and then she was no more.
How old were you when she passed?
I did the math, did the ciphering actually earlier today. From birth to her death, I had her with me for 35 years.
Oh, okay.
She was 72, and let's see, so that was 97. So that's 26 years. That's she was 33. I mean, I was 33 when she passed.
So reading the line about the mom
in the hospital.
And, triggered all of
and
that.
30 and 30 and you know 30 33 years just
or, you know, one of the things that this book
50 years when you get right down to it just went in a puff of smoke.
It's incredible. I when this book is written, for those of you who just heard it and are familiar with the books, is written in the cadence of the Sally, Dick, and Jane books. And one of the things that readers have said to me is that because of that, some of this became a little more palpable for them, because the little kid in them like knows that sing-songy tone.
Yes.
You know, that rhythm. And I hadn't read from this book in a little while. I haven't done a reading from it in a few months. Maybe it's a few months. It seems like a long time to me. And might not be. But I was really struck by, oh, right, I forgot about this language does stuff to you. That was one of the reasons why the books were so popular. There's, you know, some See Dick Run, you know, Run Dick Run. I mean, there's something about that that works under the skin. And, you know, here I'm writing about emotional, provocative stuff. So in some ways, it's not surprising to me that it would, you know, hit a nerve. I'm sorry that
no apology necessary, but it's the power of the written word to create entire tableau of memory and feeling. I mean, sight and smell. It's all, that's the thing. Great writing can do that. It can bring all of that forward. And I think you do that. I think you do that magnificently. And I love the power of poetry to do that, because it would, good God, this book of relatively, as you say, short, staccato language would take 1,000 pages to write as a narrative.
You know, I'm,
because there's so much buried underneath it.
I am poised to teach a workshop on adapting essays into poems, and that's really what it's about. Is, you know, it's a distillation. You know, it's really honing down on what are the headlines here, folks. What do we need to get to? It's a very different animal than prose in that regard. You're really zeroing in on stuff. It's a fascinating process.
What you do with the description at the beginning of Sally, Dick, and Jane Sound It Out, like, I don't remember Helene in my first grade class, but I think there was a, you know, you in New York, me in Alabama, I think there was a certain standardization to it all.
Yes, absolutely.
We're going to make little obedient patriots. We're going to border the classroom in the ABCs, just like the Bible verses that are plated in gold around the ceiling of the Vatican. We're going to have at the time the 36 apotheosized gods, except for the president who's alive. And you know, there's going to be a flag, and there are going to be sounds, and I want people to buy the book, so I don't want to get too much into the into the content. But
well,
it's amazing.
Thank you. You know, one of the things the book sets up right out of the gate is, you know, the teacher having us stand up and say the Pledge of Allegiance. You know, so there was one of the other things we had to do, one of the other inculcations, one of the other incantations in a way.
Yes.
The rules are rolled right out. And boy, do I remember that. There was something about having to stand there and pledge allegiance. I mean, this is so powerful. And felt, you know, look, this was, so I was in first grade in 1966. The Vietnam War was getting going. I had three older brothers who all became draft age. And so I grew up in a house where the flag had a lot of meanings and a lot of implications. And I found myself writing a lot about America in this book.
Yes.
And America, and also immigration and where my family was from. It was really funny how these things snuck in there.
But they're there because they need to be there.
They needed to be there. And then, you know, you sort of go in as a kind of clinician editor and you decide what belongs, what stays, and you start to refine the work. But it was fascinating to write from this little girl's point of view to some degree, of course, through my lens, and see what just sort of came out, and how it all started to feel of one piece. It didn't feel segmented to me. It felt like, yeah, this is all part of this kid's reality. You know, whether that included Russia, that included Vietnam, you know, all kinds of stuff gets in there.
I did want to touch base on this one thing. You briefly mentioned your father in another context.
Yeah.
But your father was a World War II vet.
Yes, he had been a Marine.
Was he in the South Pacific?
No, he was in Cuba.
Wow.
The whole time. He was part of, I think that he was part of sort of this educational branch of the Marines to educate other Marines. And he was in Guantanamo for the majority of it. And by the way, loved it. He said I grew up with him saying that these were his favorite years of his life. And his Marine jacket is actually referenced in one of these poems.
Yes.
Because one of my brothers asked for it and still has it. With the three stripes. And my other brother has my father's Marine ring, which is what my brother uses as his wedding band.
Oh, my heavens.
Yeah. Like the long arms of these things, you know?
Sure. I mentioned because my father was a World War II veteran of the Navy in the South Pacific.
That's where my uncle, my father's brother, had been stationed.
And I think, because that war was so noble and so right and so good, because we were doing something that I don't think the United States of America has the courage to do right now, and that is to confront fascism.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it be at home or overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's terrifying to see fascism on the rise. And
I've
been screaming about it for almost two decades now.
Yeah.
But that war was so good and so noble that the people who came back from it, primarily men, you had your parade, back to work. And it's only through the lens of looking backwards that I've realized that my father had a brutal case of PTSD.
Did he?
Untreated and unaddressed.
I think many of those soldiers are in the same boat, no pun intended. But, the interesting thing for me was that when my brothers became draft age for the Vietnam War, but my father was against the war. But I remember him feeling very mixed about it because he felt that as a veteran, that one should be patriotic and go to war when the government says we need to. It was a mixed bag for him, is what I'm saying. He was against it, but he felt mixed about it. It's complicated for him.
Oh, I think it was for my father too, because he saw it. The idea of dodging the draft or avoiding the draft, whatever one calls it, was obnoxious to him.
Mm-hmm.
Because he had been snatched up out of a coal mine and sent halfway around the planet, and he did so willingly and proudly.
Well, the story in my house, and I have to believe it's true, was that my father's mother signed him up for the Marines. She sent him on his merry way. That is the story I grew up with. No one has ever said that story is not true, so I have to believe it is true. And my mother was the person who would relate this story, and she would always say it between her teeth because it always made her mad. And what that meant was that my father had to leave college. He was at Johns Hopkins studying business to go into the war. Yeah, he grew up in Baltimore, and he was a really bright guy. And he spoke many languages. He read many languages.
Do you think your grandma did that because of some sense of obligation out of the immigrant experience?
I have no idea. I think that it's Grandma Rosie. I think Rosie might have even been born here. Rosie was one of 17 children. It was one dad and two wives. When the first one died after 9 or 10 kids, I think the story goes that he wrote to the matchmaker in Russia and they sent another one, a new wife. And in fact, Grandma Rosie was one of the babies. So the aunts that I met were the ones that were still alive. And they were mostly all women, and a lot of them were redheads. So I once went to a family gathering, and most of them were for the South, Jewish redheads. they were a very interesting bunch. I don't know why Grandma Rosie decided to enlist her youngest son. I have no idea. I never got the full story on it. None of us did, though we all think it's true because no one said it wasn't true. So who knows?
It's amazing the little secrets that our families carry to their graves.
Oh, I'd say.
In the case of, you know, my father went because it's what Appalachian people do. Oh, you got a war? I'm going to get out of the mountains for a little bit. Might not die in a coal mine. Sign me up.
Because
I don't know if Dan's ever told you, but on a per capita basis through the history of this country, West Virginia has sent more people to war on a per capita basis than any other state in the Union.
I am aware of that. And for listeners out there, Dan is my husband who grew up in West Virginia.
Yes.
And you two know each other from college, right?
Is that how
you
do? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I am aware of that.
1983.
Hmm. That's when you started college?
No, that's when I transferred to West Virginia.
Oh, I see.
I had spent my first 2 years of college at a little liberal arts college out in Missouri.
Oh.
And my father wanted to be a high school football coach.
Uh-huh.
And his greatest desire was to go to Marshall, another university here in West Virginia, play football, and be a football coach.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, that ship sailed and sunk.
Okay.
But all my life it was, you know, he told me the lore of WVU, because that's, and I don't want to piss my Marshall friends off, but, you know, that's, Marshall's older than WVU, but WVU is the state university.
Right, right.
And so when I got tired of going to a little liberal arts college with 700 students, I said, could I go to WVU? He said, sure. Love it. And so I transferred and met your husband, Dan Fisher, in August of 1983.
Well, there you go.
I did want to touch on one last thing before we wrap the conversation up, because this is all about, you know, Dick and Jane and Sally, and you and your family, but the jumping off point is that series of books.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, and I had them as a child, there were McGuffey's readers, and whatever objection one lodges about Dick and Jane and Sally, what a horror McGuffey's readers were.
I don't even know about them. So now I have to start Googling.
Oh, my God. The racism alone will keep you busy for a month.
Right there. Okay. That could be the whole new book.
Yeah.
Oh, look at that.
Oh, it's
online.
I mean, my goodness gracious. But what I was actually going to ask about, Helene.
Yes.
Is these books are coming out, especially, you know, by the time you get to the late 50s and early 60s, these books are coming out contemporaneously with people like P.D. Eastman and Go Dog Go and Put Me in the Zoo.
Yes.
And of course, Dr. Seuss.
Absolutely.
Do you have... And they're written, especially Dr. Seuss and P.D. Eastman, they're written on the same basic level.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts on the on these as academic texts, so to speak, versus Green Eggs and Ham or One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish?
Yeah, well, my understanding is that the Sally, Dick, and Jane books were vetted and developed by educators. And so they were tested out. And there's a tremendous amount of information out there about, you know, why the idea of simplifying language, of why that worked. And because they were anchored around these very specific characters who were human, who did human things, they were supposed to be relatable, which was supposed to help children read and understand the content. I mean, I'm sure there are dissertations out there comparing them. I bet there are. If there are, if you've written that and you have your PhD, let us know.
Do please.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because Dr. Seuss characters, there's some kinds of humans in them, but there are also lots and lots of different creatures and so forth. They're fanciful and they're not out to teach something per se. They're not out to teach language per se. And I would also say that they're more poetic.
Far and away.
You know, and they're, I mean, talk about sing song, you know, left foot, right foot, right. Feet in the day, feet in the night. I think they're pretty different animals. And I did do some reading about these different early readers in general. But I'm not a scholar around it, but I do understand that Sally Dick and Jane's intention was not to entertain per se, but to teach language in a way that, for example, the idea of using words that repeat over and over and over, run, jump, all of that sound and was supposed to teach not just how to read, ra'an,
but how to speak.
And also how to connect them to the content. So that the words were connected for a child to the content. What's the concept behind leap, run, jump? Dog. Dog. I see a dog. Spot. See, spot, run. Run, spot, run. Spot.
I'm glad you mentioned spot, because our buddy Randy Radar just wrote in a little bit ago and said, don't forget spot.
Yeah, spot. Spot. Spot actually, and there's a cat as well. And in the cat, there's these books are sort of written episodically. They're very bizarre in that way. You know, like things will just sort of happen and then they go away and you're on to the next story. But in that same chapter where Sally is going to bed and her mom is tucking her in, she swats her cat Puff off the bed. And it's a very violent moment. And when I got to that page, I kept coming back to it. And eventually that gets worked into the book. I was so surprised to see how angry a character in a children's book is. It's a very realistic moment. She's frustrated. And there's another moment where Sally's, you know, as many little kids might do with their older siblings, she, you know, goes to stand in front of the TV while her older brother and sister are watching.
Yes.
And her brother very violently, like, takes the chair and moves her, you know. There is a, you will not find that in Dr. Seuss or P.D. Eastman.
No.
There, but I was so surprised to see that kind of behavior in these books. Of course, they're never talked about, not at least not in my classroom. And maybe that's supposed to have made them more relatable. From a poetry point of view, it was a landmine. Like a gold mine, not a landmine, but a gold mine. It's an interesting slip. Because I was so amazed that this existed in this, you know, little children's reader. But, you know, life is not pretty or tidy, even if you're a little kid. And that is part of what these books.
You make me wonder, Helene, if there's an aspect, does the business with the chair and the TV come after or before Sally swats the cat?
I think I'm looking. I'd have to look at the book. I feel like bedtime came before the chair incident when Dick moves her. It does in my book, and I think that if memory serves, bedtime came before them watching TV.
I started wondering if it was a sort of violent, you know, poop rolls downhill.
Mm-hmm. You mean that is something she learned from the older brother?
Yeah. Or that she was dealt with peremptorily by her brother, and she took it out on the cat.
You know, we just don't know. I mean, that assumes that. And then, so where did the brother learn it, right?
Well,
right. So maybe it's, you know, maybe mom and her pearls, or maybe when dad gets home, he's a disciplinarian.
The patriarchy is a hell of a drug.
Yes, right. We really don't know. And I don't, you know, obviously, like, when you're learning to read, well, maybe it's not obvious. Like, these are not supposed to be part of the classroom lesson. But if you go back and look at these books and start to really just stare at the images, look at what's happening, look at their faces, there is so much subtext going on that is never addressed in the classroom or any classroom I have ever seen anyway. I think there's even a line in here about Mrs. W, the teacher, never talks about how mad the kids get. Although she's seen Mrs. W mad, the speaker sees Mrs. W mad.
Yes.
Like there's an exclamation point at the end of her face. I think it's described as. It's, you know, when you go in and do this kind of work and you're analyzing something or just frankly just staring at it and letting it, you know, and absorbing it, all kinds of things happen. And that's sort of the magic of this process. So there were certain observations that happened, like Dick being in a dress.
Yes.
You know, it's like, wow.
Yeah, that didn't have any meaning.
Yeah, I mean, no one was talking about, oh, my gosh, Dick was in a dress.
Gross.
Certainly the first time I can recall seeing a boy in a dress. So there's all kinds of things.
I guess the Moms for Liberty would have that right off the shelf in Florida now.
I know, right? There you go. There you go.
Well, it all becomes so much clearer now, Helene.
Well, there you go. Now we're on to Dick. And of course, the last chapter is Dick, a good sport, because he's always just sort of like going with the flow. Whatever is needed, the boy steps in, future man, to help. He's constantly, unless he's doing something not nice, which he does a few times as well. And I thought that was really interesting about Dick the helper.
Mm-hmm.
Sally always needs help. Dick is always helping. And Jane just sort of smiles.
Jane's the middle kid. She's almost invisible.
She's almost and totally neutral. She doesn't emote.
She almost always smiles.
She almost always smiles. That's her reaction. If something sort of violent happens, that's her reaction. If something good happens, she's smiling. She's a good little girl, in quotes.
This is so powerful, Helene, and I have appreciated so much this hour. Actually, a little over an hour. This is, we have beautiful conversations that could go on for hours upon hours.
I know. Thank you so much for.
Well, you can't leave yet. We have to get we have to get to the important part. How do people get their own copy of Jane almost always smiles.
So there's a few ways to do it. One is to go to my website, which is hefisher.com. And there's no C in that Fisher, just F-I-S-H-E-R, hefisher.com. And my books are right on the homepage. Or you can go to Moonstone Press, which is actually Moonstone Arts Center, and find the book there.
Well, it is beautiful, and it obviously sent me running off down the various halls and highways and byways of my memory.
Wow. Well, thank you.
And I love the power of it, and I love the honesty of it. And I love the thought provocation that takes place in it, because, you know, all these things are exactly what poetry is supposed to do.
Mm.
And God help me, I love it.
Well, on that note, thank you so much, Robin. Always a pleasure.
Oh, it's always a joy, Helene. Thank you so much. So very, thank very you. Much. Have a lovely evening. And I hope your coming summer is simply wonderful. Is there already something new in the works, or are you just sort of reveling in this now?
No, I have been writing what will, the new collection in progress is happening, which is about distortions. And, I have been writing, and, hopefully there'll be a book sometime.
Yay. And the minute there is, I hope you'll let me know.
You betcha. Thank you.
Helene Fisher, thank you so, so very much. And have
my
a wonderful
pleasure.
Evening. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Again, the book from Moonstone Press. Go to hefisher.com. Jane almost always smiles. And Helene's other books are there as well. I promise you'll be glad you did. I mean that with all the sincerity in my heart. I'm going to reread it, because it's worth the reread. I mentioned the poem that popped up in Ted Lasso yesterday evening. It is by a man named Philip Larkin. And it's called This Be the Verse. They fuck you up, your mom and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old-style hats and coats, who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can. Don't have any kids yourself. Wow. I heard that last night, and I said, I got to find out what that is. And there's a lot of weight in there. So we are into the third hour of the program. There's other stuff to go into. Conversation of your own, if you'd like, feel free to ring in either on the stress line, 844-843-4676, 844-THE-HORN, or via Skype, Robin, R-O-B-Y-N, Kincaidhorn, K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. And either one gets you into the program easily and promptly. And we do have challenges on the table. Thus far, our pal Christopher is the only one to respond to our tripling challenge, the Big Wheels Keep on Rolling challenge. And if there is another $23 out there, that challenge will be completed. And that will result in a net $100 out of the horrifying financial hole we're in. $16.58 so far. If that challenge is met, it goes to $15.58. And then Ralph's has a $25 challenge on the table. And that would get us down to $15.08. So what it boils down to, 28, we need to raise $48 to meet the two challenges that are on the table in the remaining 45 minutes of the program. That having been said, let's see, where were we? Oh, yes, we were at, and I'm still surprised that old Balls and Strikes John Roberts didn't do a spit take, or actually that the audience didn't do a spit take when he said that the Supreme Court operates at the highest standards of conduct. Oh, please. But I saw this one earlier today, and it caught my attention. These people. All this goes back, as so many things do. You know, it seems like in the present, either things go back to January 6, 2021, or they go back to the aftermath of the cop lynching of George Floyd. Well, in this case, it's the latter. And it has to do with a woman named Stephanie Rapkin, who is 67 years old. And yesterday, she was hailed into court because of her conduct in June of 2020, when this old white woman showed up at an anti-racism protest in the greater Milwaukee area. She deliberately parked her car in the street to try to block the protest. And protesters came up to her and asked her to move her car. She, of course, refused. A man named Eric Lucas then came along, who had been one of the organizers of the march, at which point 67-year-old Stephanie Rapkin spit in his face. Well, today was Consequences Day for 67-year-old Stephanie Rapkin. And she went into court. She had previously been charged with a hate crime, but, well, a judge decided not to let that charge stick. But she did face sentencing on the lesser misdemeanor. And yesterday, a county judge in Milwaukee named Laura Crivello told Stephanie Rapkin that she was perfectly willing to let her walk, give her clemency. The clemency would have been a year of probation and 100 hours of community service. Stephanie Rapkin, the lawyer, however, said, "It's not viable. I'd rather go to jail right now and take care of it." And she, of course, had her own pettifogger, who later told the press that, well, her life has been completely altered by all of this. You know, as if Eric Lucas, in whose face she spat, or the people who asked her to stop blocking a peaceful protest, were somehow at fault. Oh, her life's been completely altered. Anthony Cotton, the pettifogger, said that, in an interview with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, that, well, her neighbors won't socialize with her. And she's received death threats, and she's been, oh, no, she's been called a racist. Maybe, I don't know, maybe she can get Marginal Trailer Queen to bring her a cookie or something, because we all know that Marge says, being referred to as a white supremacist, you know, which Marge is, is absolutely the same thing as using, you know, that word that begins with N. So Stephanie Rapkin is going to do 60 days in the county stir. And she still faces a much more serious charge of having assaulted a police officer. Because the day after she spat in the face of Eric Lucas, the cop showed up, at which point Stephanie Rapkin kneed the cop in the balls. So she will be tried by jury on that charge in August of this year. And you know why she took the jail, right? It wasn't the year of probation. It was the 100 hours of community service. Because in cases like this, community service also often involves, well, learning to do a little bit better in regard to the people for whom you have manifested such disgust. I wonder if there'll be a clemency offer for her to do 100 hours of community service and a year of probation for kneeing the cop in the balls. I got a feeling that kneeing a cop in the balls probably carries a more significant penalty. And the cop union would have a fit if they gave her a walk for kneeing a cop in the balls. I'm sure the cop union is completely silent over the fact that she spat in the face of a perfectly peaceful individual. As I said earlier, I'm not particularly interested in that little go-go booted twerp announcing for president on Twitter this evening. He has since, the little go-go booted twerp, has since tried to have his announcement on Twitter Spaces. Only, well, one may hope the rest of his campaign goes exactly as this did. Because the Gannett story and covering it said that it didn't go exactly as planned. It was supposed to start an hour and 23 minutes ago at 6 p.m., but they couldn't quite get it to work on time. And then once they got it started, the feed crashed. The moderator said, "Oh, we've got so many people here that we're kind of melting the servers, which is a good sign." Yeah, make lemonade out of lemons, David Sachs, you sack. So they got the feed started again, and then it crashed again, and then they started it again, and crashed again, and somebody said, "Oh, we're just trying to get it going. There's so many people." Well, if anybody has a ready room and a reaction room, it's Nitwit Nero. "This is a clown show," said one maggot sycophant. I mean, he's not wrong, but the head bozo is Nitwit Nero. So, 20 minutes late, people were able to hear, and certainly not interact with, Ron Monkey Up DeClantis speechifying. He babbled on about how he's going to take the oath of office as the 47th president of the United States. Please, dream on. Cue up the Aerosmith. And somewhere along the way, he made sure to, because, you know, Leon Scum could buy Ron Monkey up to Clantus for what he's worth and sell him for what he thinks he's worth and not really miss the money. Among other things, he did say, no books have been banned in the state of Florida. Liar! He called it a hoax. I guess that works, you know, just telling people that chicken shit is chicken salad, you know, when it comes to Republicans. No books have been banned. And then he tried to claim, no one's made more money for Disney than me. Of course, he's looking for the anti-vax vote. Maybe Bobby Kennedy Jr. can be his running mate. Ew. I mean, he's pals with Steve Bannon, after all. He said, we've got to overhaul the CDC and other health agencies. I think all of those agencies need to be cleaned out. Major overhauls of the whole enchilada. Really? Enchilada monkey up? And he had to deal with the elephant in the room, the fact that the NAACP and the Human Rights Campaign have said, yeah, maybe don't travel to Florida. Claiming that Florida's unsafe is a total farce. I mean, are you kidding? Our crime streak is at a 50-year low. In Baltimore, in Chicago, because kids are more likely to get shot than get a first-class education. I don't see the NAACP batting an eye at that. Well, you know, the NAACP has batted an eye. They've talked about the fact that if there are less semi-automatic assault weapons on the streets, that maybe more kids get to grow up. Gun violence being the number one cause of death among children in the United States now. One of these days, we're going to have to reckon with that. Nitwit Nero wasn't the only one needling monkey up. The Biden-Harris campaign was there, too. President Biden's, well, he tweeted out a donation button said, this link works. Well, that's going to leave a mark. The little go-go booted fascist is referring to his campaign as the Great American Comeback. You know, because Make America Great Again is taken. But now that he's announced and he's filed his formal paperwork, it is going to be a 24/7 shitstorm against him, monkey up that is, from the Nitwit Nero camp. The Jeb Bushing and Marco Rubioing of Ron Monkey Up DeClantis has begun. And while ultimately this is going to result in a contest in November of 2024 that will determine whether some of us even live or die, the Schadenfreude is strong. And it's going to be fun to watch those two beat the living tar out of each other. And by the way, the Big Wheel Keep on Turning challenge out there is a 2-for-1 tripling challenge. A mere $23 more will net 100, because Christopher got us started. 23 bucks. And it would be nice to be able to pay for my appointment tomorrow. That's where we are. Well, it is prayer meeting Wednesday, so this is really gross. Trigger warning. Because I'm triggered all to hell. Yesterday with Matt Dysphoria Beard Walsh tweeting basically an encouragement to for the maggots, basically, to attack Pride celebrations. Well, they always have to one-up each other. And so enter Jason Graber. He's one of those gospel sharps from the New Independent Fundamentalist Baptist cult. And he preaches at the Sure Foundation Baptist Church in Spokane, Washington. And he had a little something to say. As a Christian, and you know how I know he's a Christian? Because other Christians won't say that he isn't. I don't think he's a Christian. If we're going to talk about demons like we did at the beginning of the program, this dude's a demon. I mean, and their name is Legion. But he is, as usual, a pasty-faced, young, white dude, filled with hate. And this is, and remember, this is protected speech because of our fetishized approach to so-called free speech. He can say anything he wants. And as long as he's hiding behind Jesus' lace skirts, he gets away with it. That having been said, trigger warning, I tried to put that out there earlier. This is what American fascists hate, cloaked in religion. When fascism comes to America, it will be wrapped in a flag and carrying a Bible. Well, this is what that sounds like.
To any parents that would have their child have a transgender surgery done on them, any parent that would do that, they just need to be shot in the back of the head. They need to be convicted in trial and immediately shot in the back of the head. Okay? And then we can string them up above a bridge. And so that the public can see the consequences of that kind of wickedness. Yeah. And so there should be no excuse to not put these people to death. No excuse whatsoever. And go ahead and turn to Ephesians chapter number 4. And let me tell you, there are very, very few people out there in the world today that are actually fighting the spiritual fight. I want you to go ahead and find me another preacher in Spokane to preach the message where they said that these child molesters, that these child butchers, that these all the LGBTQ people, people that desire strange flesh, that they should all be put to death in a public execution by the government. Find me the preacher that says that. I want to see him.
Look in the mirror, turd. At least they tell us where they stand. I guess I have to add the disclaimer that no gender-affirming surgeries are being done on children. None. There are no genital surgeries at all taking place on children. None. But he doesn't care. And he only talked about putting a bullet in the back of the heads of the parents, but while he's at it, he's got a bullet for the kid, too. And he doesn't just want them killed. He wants them tried, convicted, shot in the back of the head, and then strung up above a bridge. You know, as was done frequently throughout the course of American history, let's call it what it is. This guy is calling for the lynching of the parents of trans kids. This is fascism. He also babbles on and on about how LGBTQ stands for let God burn them quickly. Now, they call themselves the Independent Fundamentalist Baptist. New Independent Fundamental Baptist Church. I have yet, and maybe this is the important part, I have yet to see any sort of communique, any sort of statement from any kind of other Baptist church, American Baptist, Southern Baptist, Free Will Baptist, Hard Shell Baptist, Soft Shell Baptist, saying that this man is in no wise a Baptist. This isn't the kind of horsing around we usually do on Prayer Meeting Wednesday. And I hope people can understand that this is who he wants to shoot in the back of the head right now. There will be others. There already are others. The centerpiece of this cult of Baptists is the LGBTQ community. But we've already seen through the course of the pandemic that these people are perfectly willing to call for violence against healthcare workers, people who administer vaccines, people who receive vaccines. He even said that he would rather, sorry, this is Stephen Anderson, who said he would rather, and this goes back a little ways, eat his own vomit than be gay. Something tells me that at some point in time, Stephen Anderson, you know, like Jesse Lee Peterson, is going to be caught with a man in its mouth.
And what these people do is every bit as gross, yay, much grosser than eating your own vomit. I would rather eat my own vomit out of a bowl with a spoon every day for the rest of my life until I'm 100 years old.
I think you could use a fork for the chunky parts.
Than to engage in what they do one single time.
Well, isn't it? He seems nice. But please understand that this is where the battle against fascism is. And he's in... He's in Spokane. Spokane, Washington. Which is not necessarily on the so-called liberal side of Washington. But Washington has protections in place for people in the LGBTQ community. But Spokane is no small place. It is a city. Oh, let's go ahead and look it up. Don't know that much about Spokane. I'll know more when I'm done here. Population of Spokane is 228,989. That means there's probably about 2,200 trans people in Spokane, just extrapolating from averages. And I don't know what it would be like to know that this guy was out there in my city encouraging his congregation to kill me. But ignorance is bliss, I guess. Because I'm sure that same shit is being preached right here where I live. Well, you're right, Emilio. Now we know what kind of porn he likes. Vomit porn. And there went dinner in the Pacific Daylight Time Zone and my after-show snack. But you're not wrong. Stochastic terrorism is a real thing. But of course, if one of his congregants goes out and does the unspeakable, the unthinkable, unfortunately it's entirely thinkable, he'll say, but I had a First Amendment right to say it. And our most puissant, dread sovereign, supreme Catholic majesties on the court will say, yup! And we adhere to the highest standards of ethical conduct. God. Oh, hey, Tom. Tom says, thanks for the interview. I'll be ordering Helene's book tonight. I had several wow moments during the interview. Tom signed Tom in sunny San Rafael. I know, so did I. In reading the book in advance. It's a jump. Jane Almost Always Smiles is a jumping off point for a lot of thought provoking content. Oh, and with the passing of Tina Turner, the tributes and accolades are pouring in. By the way, she passed away at her estate in Küsnacht near Zurich in Switzerland. Roger Davies said, she was a unique and remarkable force of nature with her strength, incredible energy, and immense talent. From the first day I met her in 1980, she believed in herself completely when few others did at that time. It was a privilege and an honor to have been a close friend as well as her manager for more than 30 years. Even the White House issued a statement saying it was incredibly sad news and that she showed remarkable strength. In addition to being a once-in-a-generation talent that changed American music forever, Tina's personal strength was remarkable, Joe Biden said. Overcoming adversity and even abuse, she built a career for the ages and a life and legacy that were entirely hers. Gloria Gaynor said she was an iconic legend who paved the way for so many women in rock and roll, black and white. Mariah Carey said she was a trailblazer and a survivor. Mick Jagger chimed in. He said, I'm so saddened by the passing of my wonderful friend Tina Turner. She was truly an enormously talented performer and singer. She was inspiring, warm, funny, and generous. She helped me so much when I was young, and I will never forget her. And they turned in a rousing performance during Live Aid in 1985. Oprah called her our forever goddess of rock and roll, a role model not only for me, but for the world. I started out as a fan of Tina Turner, then a full-on groupie following her from show to show around the country, and then eventually we became real friends. And mentioning Oprah Winfrey brings another story to the front. Do you recall back on January the 20th, 2021, the brilliant young woman who read her poem at the inauguration? Well, contrary to what Ron Monkey Up DeClantis says, her book, the book around which she built that the poem that she read at the inauguration, has been banned in Florida, because of course it has. No kidding. Amanda Gorman's book, The Hills We Climb, was removed from the K-5 curriculum in Miami-Dade County, Florida, based on the objection of just one dipshit, idiotic, fuckwit parent. The parent, Daily Salinas, challenged that, as well as the ABCs of Black History, Cuban Kids, Countries in the News, Cuba, and Love to Langston. Two of those books have to do with Cuba. The other ones, of course, have to do with the African-American experience. Interviewed by the Miami Herald, Daily Salinas said, "Well, I'm not in favor of censorship, but I want students to know the truth about Cuba." The Hills We Climb is not about Cuba. And it's written on a level that, you know, a fourth or fifth grader. Here we are on an evening when we've talked about kids learning to read. It's written on a level that a fourth or fifth grader could read, but it will not be available for fourth or fifth graders in Miami-Dade County. And Amanda Gorman is pissed right off, as well she should be. Amanda Gorman was the Youth Poet Laureate of 2017. And there is not a blessed objectionable word in her poem, except the fact that it centers blackness. Because that's what happens in the fascist state of Ron Monkey Up DeClantis. It's getting national coverage. Variety's covered it. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch has covered it. SF Gate has covered it. And the White House jumped in. No surprise. And took issue with the action of Ron Monkey up DeKlantis' fascist Florida. Corinne Jean-Pierre, White House spokeswoman, said the president and his administration certainly stand with her. Daily Salinas said, it could indoctrinate students. And it is banned for kids K through 5 at the Bob Graham Education Center in Miami, which is ironic insofar as Bob Graham was a Democrat from Florida. Daily Salinas is not the best at grammar. The form that she filled out, because there's a book banning form in Florida now. On it, she wrote, it is not educational and have indirectly hate messages. Cause confusion and indoctrinate students. Dipshit Daily Salinas even went, she hated the book so much she couldn't be bothered to find out who wrote it. Titled material in question, The Hill We Climb, author, publisher, Oprah Winfrey. To what do you object? Please be specific, cite pages or sections. It's blank. But she did check the box saying remove the challenged material from this total environment. Why do you object to this material? Is not educational and have indirectly hate messages, page 1213. Did you review all the material? Yes. No, you didn't. I love question 4. Are you aware of professional reviews on this material? I don't need it! What strengths do you perceive in this material? Blank. For what age group would you recommend this material? Not for schools! What do you believe is the function of this material? Cause confusion and indoctrinate students! Like I said, Amanda Gorman was pissed. She said, so they banned my book from young readers, confused me with Oprah, failed to specify what parts of my poetry they object to, refused to read any reviews, and offer no alternatives. Unnecessary book bans like these are on the rise, and we must fight back. She's right. I really want to find the audio of her reading it. Give me a sec. By the way, this would be a great time if anybody wants to help out to kick in with the last $23 that will yield a net of $100 in the Big Wheels Keep on Rolling challenge, courtesy of an anonymous friend. So, here then, via PBS NewsHour, is Amanda Gorman's poem to which Daily Salinas objects to children reading because it indoctrinates students. Not indoctrinates, it indoctrinates students.
Mr. President, Dr. Biden, Madam Vice President, Mr. Emhoff, Americans and the world. When day comes, we ask ourselves, where can we find light in this never-ending shade? The loss we carry, a sea we must wade. We've braved the belly of the beast. We've learned that quiet isn't always peace. In the norms and notions of what just is, isn't always just is. And yet the dawn is ours before we knew it. Somehow we do it. Somehow we've weathered and witnessed a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished. We, the successors of a country and a time where a skinny black girl descended from slaves and raised by a single mother, can dream of becoming president only to find herself reciting for one. And yes, we are far from polished, far from pristine, but that doesn't mean we are striving to form a union that is perfect. We are striving to forge our union with purpose, to compose a country committed to all cultures, colors, characters, and conditions of man. And so we lift our gazes not to what stands between us, but what stands before us. We close the divide because we know to put our future first, we must first put our differences aside. We lay down our arms so we can reach out our arms to one another. We seek harm to none and harmony for all. Let the globe, if nothing else, say this is true. That even as we grieved, we grew. That even as we hurt, we hoped. That even as we tired, we tried. That we'll forever be tied together, victorious. Not because we will never again know defeat, but because we will never again sow division. Scripture tells us to envision that everyone shall sit under their own vine and fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. If we're to live up to our own time, then victory won't lie in the blade, but in all the bridges we've made. That is the promised glade, the hill we climb, if only we dare it. Because being American is more than a pride we inherit. It's the past we step into and how we repair it. We've seen a force that would shatter our nation rather than share it, would destroy our country if it meant delaying democracy. And this effort very nearly succeeded. But while democracy can be periodically delayed, it can never be permanently defeated. In this truth, in this faith we trust, for while we have our eyes on the future, history has its eyes on us. This is the era of just redemption we feared, and at its inception we did not feel prepared to be the heirs of such a terrifying hour, but within it we found the power to author a new chapter, to offer hope and laughter to ourselves. So, while once we asked, how could we possibly prevail over catastrophe? Now we assert, how could catastrophe possibly prevail over us? We will not march back to what was, but move to what shall be, a country that is bruised but whole, benevolent but bold, fierce and free. We will not be turned around or interrupted by intimidation, because we know our inaction and inertia will be the inheritance of the next generation. Our blunders become their burdens. But one thing is certain. If we merge mercy with might and might with right, then love becomes our legacy and change our children's birthright. So let us leave behind a country better than one we were left. With every breath from my bronze-pounded chest, we will raise this wounded world into a wondrous one. We will rise from the gold-limbed hills of the West. We will rise from the wind-swept Northeast where our forefathers first realized revolution. We will rise from the lake-rimmed cities of the Midwestern states. We will rise from the sun-baked South. We will rebuild, reconcile and recover in every known nook of our nation, in every corner called our country. Our people, diverse and beautiful, will emerge battered and beautiful. When day comes, we step out of the shade, aflame and unafraid. The new dawn blooms as we free it. For there is always light if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it.
Okay. I heard that. You heard that. What was Daley Salinas objecting to? God, what a proud moment for Amanda Gorman. These obnoxious maggots are, and fascists. Sickening. It's sickening. But since Monkey Up Duclantis has said that there are no books banned in Florida, time to hang this one around his neck. Let him wear it a spell. Last couple of things. Target has caved. We talked a little bit last night about the conniption being had by maggots about their Pride collection. Well, they caved. They pulled some of the material some of the clothing that was pissing off the maggots. Now, surely to goodness, the maggots will go away. No, you simple souls, they won't. And the latest they're after Adidas now for trans-inclusive swimwear marketing. Some butthurt turf is tweeting, hashtag Adidas hates women. Oh, and the North Face. I like North Face clothing when I can afford it. Sometimes I find it in, like, secondhand shops. For the second time, they're having a Summer of Pride marketing campaign. And it centers on drag queen and environmentalist Patty Gagne. I get it, Patty Gagne, huh? Telling people to get outside. This caused marginal trailer queen to have a baby. Accusing North Face of sexually targeting children. It gets so wearisome. But there was a moment in the Congress today. Marge decided that there wasn't enough decorum in the House of Representatives. This occasioned a precious little moment. Because she had the gavel. See, she was... Interim speaker. She was interim speaker for an hour and a half or something.
The members are reminded to abide by decorum of the House.
They're laughing at you, you cloven hoof demon. Nah. Spell decorum, dipshit.
House will be in order.
I think I'm going to hang on to that clip. The entire Democratic caucus, and probably secretly some Republicans, going, yeah, you're just the woman for that. I love that. Sorry, something you take your little joyful moments where you can find it. Thank you, Emilio. Emilio got us down to $18. $18 to go to fulfill the tripling challenge. The big wheels keep on turning challenge in memory of Tina Turner. that will net us $100. So now the both of the challenges, $33 gets us $150. If there's anybody still out there listening. This is too funny. I'm loving this. So Nimrata Haley, went to New Hampshire. Remember, this is the same Nimrata Haley who is so damn smart. She got punked by the Moscow Morning Zoo crew. At 91.2, the Vulgar Boltman. She got punked by the Moscow Morning Zoo crew into thinking that she was talking to the president of Poland. And carried on a lengthy discussion about the supporting democracy in the island nation of Bonomo. God. That should have ended her career. But it didn't. But this morning, she thought she had a real winner of an opener for the crowd of folks, maggots in the, in the Granite State. And she said, everybody know about Dylan Mulvaney? Bud Light? That is a guy dressed as a girl making fun of women? And the Granite Staters sat there granite-faced. Because it was the politics and eggs breakfast at St. Anselm College, the college that threw its reputation right down the toilet by hosting Nitwit Nero's little Clavering rally on CNN. But Dave Weigel said, you know, the politics and eggs gang is a polite crowd of businessmen and nonprofit people, not a raucous Trump-style audience. On the other hand, she got some claps when she said, it's time to take the wokeness out of the military. Her campaign's barely going, but somehow she's come perilously close to her Jeb Bush please clap moment. Nobody laughed. Nobody clapped. So that's the program this evening. Hopefully the overnight crowd will respond and help out a little bit. Fundraising goal is just getting higher and higher and higher. We are unfunded for a solid week now. A solid week of broadcasting plus is unfunded. I'm sorry to talk about it, but this is how this is what keeps the program going. So thanks to our Patreon and PayPal subscribers. Thank you so very much. Thank you to our a la carte contributors. Thank you, Christopher. And thank you, Emilio. And thank you to our anonymous friend and Ralphs for the challenges as yet unmet. Thank you. Thanks to each and every one of you who share your precious finite time engaging in this program in whatever manner you so choose. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Don't know if anybody showed up in the chat room this evening, but thanks just the same to Steve and Roger and Sparky. Hey, there's Steve. Or there was Steve. Skeeve! Soup! Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa. Head on .live. Remember, like and subscribe to the program. The podcast. Leave a comment. It helps. It's growing the numbers. It really does make a difference. By the way, Brother Deacon Asa, when I mentioned not knowing much about Spokane, Brother Deacon Asa pointed out, Spokane is the Mississippi of the Pacific Northwest. Well, then everything makes sense, because I'm sure there's one of those creepy-ass churches in Mississippi stand, too. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks of Cold River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, 20-plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia at a proud union shop. Get your booster if you qualify and you can afford it. Wear your mask when you're around maggots. They're disease spreaders. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face. Use your hand sanitizer. Carry it with you everywhere you go, pocket or purse. Don't drink it. Don't be like the deacons. Maintain your social distance. And above all, well, if some idiot comes toward you, it indoctrinate the children. Avoid daily Salinas like a plague, because she is. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later.